Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving in sunny California.
And I'm Ken Reardon in our nation's capital, where just several days ago we have a new Supreme Court justice nominated.
Ken, I was hoping you would say, I'm here in cloudy Washington, D.C., because, you know, once you get out in the country, you look back at Washington, things seem quite murky there.
Actually, things are very clear. We have history in the making. We have the first Hispanic woman named to the United States Supreme Court.
As a matter of fact, this issue of whether or not she is even the first Hispanic nominee has become one of the points raised by the opponents of this nomination. They seem to be trying to belittle it slightly by saying she might be the first Hispanic woman, but not the first Hispanic named to the court. What's that all about?
Well, because, well, Benjamin Cardozo, who was named to the Supreme Court in the 1930s, I believe by President Herbert Hoover in 1932.
That is
and,
correct.
Of course, he has Portuguese heritage, and a lot of the people who are trying to downplay the history of this new appointment are saying that, well, you know, it's really not history in the making. After all, we have had Hispanic before, and, of course, we've had two women before, so this is just really, we should not talk about any kind of history here.
What would be the purpose or point of that? Would there be a voting block here in question?
Well, of course, as Chuck Schumer, who is going to shepherd this nomination through the Senate, said this week, he said that Republicans vote against this nominee at their peril. And I assume what that means is that if you really want to alienate female voters, if you really want to alienate Hispanics, then you vote against Sonia Sotomayor.
Well, it's a curious strategy, it seems to me, for Karl Rove writing in the Wall Street Journal and other conservatives to flat deny that Sonia Sotomayor is the first Hispanic justice, because they seem to be saying, look, don't get too excited about this if you happen to be a Hispanic voter. Don't get too jazzed about this, because really, this isn't a big deal to you. I'm not exactly sure they're in a position to dictate what people feel is a, in some sense or another, salute to their ethnicity or to their voting group.
And yet there's no question that the little code words that you're hearing from some Republicans is exactly what they want to do. When Newt Gingrich is suggesting that she should withdraw her nomination because she's a racist, when Rush Limbaugh says she's a reversed racist, obviously they want to remind you that she's not like us. She has a different heritage via her parents coming from Puerto Rico. But so perhaps part of it is saying that, well, this is not history in the making. And the other part is, well, she really is kind of a little different, and maybe we should be aware of that.
Well, and actually there's a third leg on that stool, and that is that I've seen her criticized as someone who is not a distinguished judge, but actually kind of an affirmative action figure, somebody who got on the district court appointed by George H.W. Bush back during his presidency, I believe, 1992.
Correct.
Because she was Hispanic, and then elevated to the Circuit Court of Appeals by Bill Clinton in 1998 for the same reason, because she was Hispanic. And now she's supposedly getting this ultimate elevation to the Supreme Court for yet the same reason. So I've seen that argument.
But here's a big difference between Sotomayor replacing a Rehnquist and replacing a David Souter. And I suspect ultimately the Republicans will not expend that much energy and that much political capital in trying to fight her, because ultimately this is not changing the ideological makeup of the court. David Souter is a reliably or fairly reliably liberal vote on the court. I suspect Sotomayor may be the same. But of course, if it were an Anthony Kennedy or somebody on the conservative side, then you would have World War III.
That's when you'd see the nuclear option.
I agree. And you know, it's also interesting in the fact that here we are talking about how the Republicans are painted in a corner. They're in a lose-lose situation. Just a week or so ago, we were talking about what a bad week the Obama White House was having. What about Nancy Pelosi? What did she know? What about his decision on Guantanamo? Is it backfiring on him? The Republicans were pounding their chest saying that the White House was on the defensive, and boom, you have this one Supreme Court justice nomination, and the whole calculation changes, where it's now Republicans seem to not know exactly how to respond.
By the way, in this particular instance, on Tuesday morning, I think we have to tip our hat to whoever is in charge of keeping secrets in this White House. I have never seen a decision of this magnitude made with so little leakage. At 8 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday Eastern time, nobody knew even that there was going to be an announcement that morning, let alone what the name would be.
You know, what also struck me is that, of course, as you know, Sonia Sotomayor was born in the Bronx, and she's a fanatic Yankees fan. I remember back in 1969, 1970, when Richard Nixon named G. Harold Carswell to the Supreme Court, Roman Huruska, the Republican senator from Nebraska, said,
"We can't have all Brandeises and Cardozos and Frankfurters and stuff like that. There are a lot of mediocre judges and people and lawyers. Aren't they entitled to a little representation and a little chance?
Well, if she's a Yankees fan, then we can have frankfurters and mustard and sauerkraut on the Supreme Court. What do you think?
I think I'd like mine with a little ketchup as well.
And, you know, for all, we're talking about history. Here's another history here. We're talking about, oh, yes, the first Latina, only the third woman in history, perhaps the first Hispanic. Do you realize that with Sotomayor on the Supreme Court, we have six Roman Catholics on the court? That's, I think, is a record.
Yes, it is. In fact, five was a record. Four was a record. It used to be that you had a token Catholic and perhaps a token Jew on the court, and the rest of the court was white, male, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant.
Right.
And that was the history of the country until really just the middle part of the 20th century. So now with this first appointment, we have six Catholics, and only one of the six, interestingly, is a liberal or somebody we expect to be in the liberal bloc of the court.
So President Obama leaves Washington, flies out west, says a few nice things about Sotomayor, but also says some nice things about an endangered Democratic senator in the West.
Harry Reid. In fact, I would go so far as to say Harry is the most endangered senator in the West in either party, and certainly the most endangered in the state of Nevada.
Yeah, he is the most endangered senator in the state of Nevada. That's a good
yes,
call, Ron.
Yes, no question.
You are
no
a
question.
Gutsy guy.
12 years ago, he was nearly defeated by John Ensign, right, who then subsequently became his colleague in the Senate when he won the other Senate seat from the state. Who's he up against this year, Ken?
Exactly. And that's the problem with the Republican Party. They talk about how vulnerable Harry Reid is, that polling numbers in Nevada show that he is not well-liked, and that is true. But you can't beat somebody with nobody, and right now nobody is the leading candidate for the Republican nomination against Harry Reid.
And Harry Reid picked up some change on the back of Barack Obama's visit this week, and Barack Obama said a lot of nice things about Harry Reid. I think Harry would like him to stay in the state because he doesn't hear that many nice things said about him, either in the state or back in Washington very often these days. Could he be added to the list of Senate majority leaders who have, by concentrating on their duties back in the nation's capital, sacrificed their political base at home and been defeated?
Well, actually, the thing is, the last Senate Majority Leader to be defeated for re-election was
Tom Daschle.
No, he was Minority Leader when he was
defeated. By then, but he had been the Majority Leader. He was the party leader.
The last Senate Majority Leader to be defeated was Ernest McFarland, beaten by Barry Goldwater in 1952. How do you like them apples?
I don't think that Ernest liked them much at all. But there is a longer list, as you go back through history, of party leaders, whether they're majority or minority, finding their base knocked out behind them because of their concentration on their duties back in Washington. And I think Harry is still in a certain amount of hazard of that happening.
Right. There's another poll came out, talking about another Democrat in trouble, Chris Dodd of Connecticut, who's in trouble for an assortment of reasons. I still suspect that he survives his reelection bid, but the latest Quinnipiac poll shows him narrowing the gap between himself and likely Republican nominee Rob Simmons, the former congressman. Simmons still has about a 5-point lead, but it's much smaller than it had been
a
few months ago, right?
Ken, as long as you're going to drag us back from the West to the East and talk about Connecticut, I think you ought to talk a little bit about what's going on in Pennsylvania. Is that getting out of control from the Democrats' point of view?
Well, the smooth sailing to the Democratic nomination for a newly anointed Democrat, Arlen Specter, may have some problems. Joe Sestak, we've talked about him on several podcasts, the former Navy Admiral, the second-term Democratic congressman from the suburbs of Philadelphia, has said this week that he's most likely going to challenge Specter in next year's Democratic primary. Now, of course, Specter does have Barack Obama, Ed Rendell, the governor, all behind him, and he has tons of money. But there is a liberal contingent out there in Pennsylvania that has not forgiven Arlen Specter for the grilling of Anita Hill, for his stuff on card check, for voting against the Obama budget. So Joe Sestak, for being Arlen Specter, I think a lot of people oppose him for that reason.
What is there to this idea that Pat Toomey and Joe Sestak could, in some sense or another, make common cause against Arlen Specter? Obviously, Sestak could be running against him in the primary, and Toomey would be waiting for his crack at him in the fall. But is there any way that there could be some sort of symbiosis between these two guys who are on opposite sides of the political spectrum but agree on one big thing, and that is that Arlen Specter should go?
Well, and Pat Toomey would love to make it a far-left versus far-right, or at least a left-versus-right election in November. And I think a lot of Republicans still maintain some loyalty to Arlen Specter. Now, Republicans don't feel the same way about Joe Sestak. And if Pat Toomey is indeed the Republican nominee, and it looks like he will be, then you think the Republican Party would unite behind Pat Toomey. And perhaps while Sestak is trying to paint Toomey as a right-wing nutball, Toomey could paint Sestak as a hopelessly naive left-wing liberal. So this should be a lot of fun in November, if that's the case. But ultimately, I still think that Al Inspector wins it.
Political paintball in Pennsylvania looks like a good year up there. Let's move on to a couple of other East Coast races that are gubernatorial races and that are not off in 2010, but are right upon us. New Jersey, Virginia primaries coming up in June.
Right, June 2nd is New Jersey. We know who the Democrat's going to be. That's going to be the incumbent Democratic governor, John Corzine. But the Republican primaries between Chris Christie, the former U.S. attorney, who most polls show will beat Corzine, you know, if the election were held today, but of course it's not, because if it were held today, then you wouldn't be in California. We'd be together. We'd be talking about politics. If the election
much would be different. Yes, much would be different.
And Christie's Republican opponent in the primary is Steve Lonergan, the former mayor of Bogota, New Jersey, not Bogota, but it's Bogota, New Jersey, in Bergen County, who is very conservative. And the question is whether he can rough up Christie to help. Nick. Nick.
Oh, Nick, you're such a tool.
Oh, stop it. And then a week later, June 9th, there's a Democratic primary, and it's in Virginia. Terry McAuliffe, the former Democratic National Committee chairman, former state delegate Brian Moran, brother of Congressman Jim Moran, and there's Cree Deeds, an unusual spelling of his name, C-R-E-I-G-H, pronounced Cree. He was endorsed by the Washington Post this week.
For his good deeds.
He is a
rural... No, seriously, what did the Washington Post see in Cree Deeds? This guy was regarded as the third team in a two-team league, and there was no thought that he was going to be a serious contender.
But he is
And now suddenly...
But he's a serious state legislator, and I think he has less baggage than Terry McAuliffe, who has a lot of...
That could be possible. Yes.
Right. And, you know, I mean, Brian Moran and McAuliffe seem to have gotten in this little hissy fit over whether, well, you know, Terry McAuliffe really didn't help Barack Obama. He was helping Hillary Clinton and blah, 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 and they're fighting over. And Deeds is running a serious campaign. I still think Deeds does finish third in the primary. Anyway, the Republican sitting by watching this whole thing is Bob McDonnell, the former state attorney general, who I think gives the Republicans a good shot of recapturing the governorship after 8 years.
Yes, I think you could say United Airlines has less baggage than Terry McAuliffe.
But I do think, though, that ultimately this will be a referendum in some ways on Terry McAuliffe, because he's well-known well before he got in the race, although not many people knew he was from Virginia. As a matter of fact, he's been living there for over 20 years. But I think that if you like Terry McAuliffe, if you vote for him, and if you don't like him, you have to decide between Moran and Deeds. By the way, so actually, as we approach the West Coast, because I'd like to talk later about Prop 8 and what the Supreme Court did there, but before we get there, on the way to California, Ron, we talked about vulnerable Democratic senators. We talked about Harry Reid. We talked about Chris Dodd. Roland Burris made the news again this week.
I think Roland Burris defines the category of vulnerable Democratic senator. The question with Roland is, does he finish out the 111th Congress? I'm not at all sure that he does. He has now been found on a piece of audio tape that was gathered in the surveillance of Governor Rod Blagojevich, specifically Rod Blagojevich's brother.
How do you spell Blagojevich?
Very carefully. He's been found on this tape essentially saying, I could do something for Rod Blagojevich's problems, which included at that time money. Of course, that seems the least of his problems today. But at the time, he was really worrying about raising money. And he was out there basically offering to give the Senate appointment for Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat to whoever could help him the most. And Burris wanted to get in on that lottery. This is specifically and precisely what he denied under oath having done when he testified in the state legislature earlier this year before he was seated in the United States Senate. It seems to be the smoking gun.
Well, did he break any laws? Well, he may have committed perjury when he testified before the impeachment commission.
Yeah, ask Bill Clinton about that being a law.
Well, and Bill Clinton survived, but I suspect Roland Burris does not survive. There are several already announced candidates to challenge him in the primary, including the son of Robert Kennedy, Chris Kennedy. But that's irrelevant.
Still enough Kennedys to go around. Every state should have a Kennedy.
But every state will not have a Burris, and I suspect that Illinois will be one of those states that will not have a Burris in the Senate. Meanwhile, on the way to California, where Ron Elving is, the news this week, of course, was that the state Supreme Court, by a 6-1 margin, voted to keep Proposition 8 intact.
Yes, because they said the voters had spoken clearly in saying that they did not want to have full recognition of gay marriage. The court did, if you will, moderate its judgment somewhat by saying that the 18,000 marriages that had already taken place could stand. But that's not really going to take any of the air out of this issue, because you've had protests all over the place in the state this week. There's still a tremendous amount of high feeling about this. And many people are already talking about getting it on the ballot again in 2010 to take it back the other way. And if you think we had a Donnybrook over this in 2008, it will only be greater in 2010.
And I'm still not convinced, and I may be a minority point of view here, but I'm still not convinced that repealing Prop 8 is the majority sense in California. I mean, there's a lot of feelings both ways on it, and there's a lot of sense that there should be no discrimination of any kind. But do I think there's a majority sentiment for same-sex marriage in California and most states? I still say there's not.
I think that it has a greater chance of approving this if the focus is actually on the proposition in 2010. And I think there's a real prospect that recasting the issues, recasting the particular mix of California voting groups in 2010, you could see the opposite result.
It's talking about, everybody talks about momentum, and of course all the states, you know, the Maine, Vermont, and Massachusetts, and Connecticut, and now Iowa, and perhaps California.
Plus, still, you know, a small minority. Right. We're still in single digits. We're a long way from this being a juggernaut, and I think that even if it had much greater momentum than it has now, that would still be resisted in the states of the South, the states of the traditional Midwest, Iowa to one side. I just think that this is still going to take some time.
But before we write off its chances in the South, let's see in what we think is hospitable territory, the New England, Northeast, California. Let's see what the state legislative elections look like in 2010, and then we'll see how much of the momentum the issue really has.
You're suggesting that those legislative elections could actually reverse the momentum, and we could wind up 4 years from now, 5 years from now, with fewer states than we have now, maybe going down to zero.
It's very possible. Let's see who could raise the money and who could make the issue work. Right now, the pro-same-sex marriage groups seem to have the most money, the most momentum, the most support. But again, all you need is some kind of a shift in momentum, and political fortunes could change in a hurry.
So we're talking about this in terms of the mechanics of passing a proposition or going to the courts. But Ken, which way do you think the basic political sympathy of the country is moving with respect to gay marriage?
Oh, I definitely think in favor of same-sex marriage. I do think that that's clearly the case. Whether the elections bear that out in 2010 is another story.
And that's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us next week for It's All Politics from NPR News.
Love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage. This I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. Love and marriage, love and marriage, it's an institute you can't disparage. Ask the local gentry and they will say it's elementary. Try, try, try to separate them. It's an illusion.